Seriously considering just referring that to finance. Do you see any reason why this has to be seen in our committee? And Reinert is asking for his bill.
We'll talk later.
Because if we can get rid of this one, we could...
We'll save that one later.
Turn this off.
Okay.
Welcome. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. It is March 10th, 2014. Beginning today's agenda is Senator Saxok. Would you come forward and present Senate File 1807?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Today, as you mentioned, I'm presenting Senate File 1807. I have the A5 amendment that I would like to have moved, please.
Okay. So moved.
The A5 amendment is in your packet.
Madam Chair, I so move.
The A5 Senator amendment. Rosen moves the A5 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Oh, wait a minute. Do we have a quorum? We do not have a quorum. So we'll hold on the motion until we have a quorum. And
Madam Chair, I just briefly say that the A5 amendment will remove all references to state agencies and will make the bill apply only to boards that are referenced in Section 214.01, subsection 2 and 3.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
As Senator Nelson pointed out, you're outnumbered right now.
Not by much.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you're a friendly group.
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Benson.
Generally, on author's amendment, we do it out of courtesy, but why are we excluding state agencies?
Obviously. Yeah, we can begin the discussion and testimony,
Chair,
and we'll proceed.
Senator Benson, the reason we are is because, as I explain this bill, you'll see that if we use state agencies, we'd probably be here till next year. Venting them all, and I'm trying to get, in the time that we have in this session, I'm trying to get as many boards included in this for the purpose that I'll talk about, and it just would be, I wouldn't have any time to do anything else if I went to every other board. Thank you for
Madam
the question.
Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to continue on that point, I think it is very important that our veterans also have expedited licensing in our state as well, and in our state government as well, because we know those jobs are very good jobs. And so my question is, and I think state government is one of our largest employers in the state as well. So is there a possibility to actually put an extension for, I understand what you're saying about getting to all those boards, but could we just add an extended time effective date for military veterans having expedited licensing processes required by state agencies and the professional licensing boards? It seems like we should be able to do that in state government. We should actually be leading, not trailing, but I'd like to at least get some sort of I'd like you to consider getting some sort of extended time in there so that we have expedited licensing for military veterans in state government as well.
Senator Saxok.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I guess my answer to that was I agree with you 100%. I think that there will be time next year and the year after to continue to add those agencies and boards that need to be, knowing when the deadline is, in reality, there's no way that I can see that these can be done by the deadline.
We have a quorum, so we'll renew Senator Rosen's motion to accept the A5 amendment. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment passes. Please continue.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and, I'm happy that everybody has a good idea, either from a previous committee or, whatever, that what this bill is all about. That makes it pretty easy with my explanation. This bill came to me from the Lieutenant Governor, who's been working with the First Lady of the United States and Dr. Jill Biden to help military members, their spouses, and recently discharged veterans who moved to this state to gain employment in a field that they might require a license. We're only one of five states in the country that has not done anything in this regard. You should have a one-page handout that has some general information about the scope of the bill. Mr. Kerr, who's with me today, mentioned to me that one of the states that hasn't done anything yet is the state of Iowa, and they're just about to do a similar work on a similar law that to the one that we will be working on today. We are before your committee today because the bill relates to health-related boards that fall under your jurisdiction. These boards met during the interim. The Policy Committee of the Health Licensing Board suggested changes that have been incorporated into the language, and the board has signed off on this legislation. Many boards already have the ability to do this and have everything in place. I'm working with all the stakeholders to make sure that we can establish a process for expediting applications and issuing temporary licenses. I think it's important to remember that the primary goal here is to have the boards defined in this bill and establish a process for expediting the applications and issuing the temporary licenses. It doesn't mandate anybody to do anything. So what we're doing here is setting up a process, not doing a mandate. With me today is Don Kerr, Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, to give brief testimony and help answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Introduce yourself again, and please present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs, and I'm here today to speak in favor of the bill. This will not be a huge benefit to our members, but we do feel it's a very important contribution as we look at the imminent downsizing of the active component of our military. Many service members and their families will be transitioning from active duty, and making the licensing process streamlined or easier for them will be a benefit to them as they transition back to civilian life. And of course, many of those folks may become members of the National Guard in the future. We just think it's the right thing to do and an appropriate step.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Kerr. Senator Saxhog, is there anything in this bill I'm looking for that would count prior experience in the military towards expedited licensing, perhaps waiving some of the requirements that would actually move things forward more quickly? I can't tell from the plain language of the bill if someone who is a master electrician in the Navy would be able to just transition immediately into master electrician status, or do they have to go through a bunch of rigmarole?
Senator Saxon or
well,
Mr. Kerr?
Well, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Kerr could help me with this, but I think that if somebody comes out of the Navy with a master electrician's license, that we would go to whichever board is in charge of issuing those licenses, and assuming that they've set up their process, which we would want them to, they would be able to get a temporary license. And we'll just assume that if all the other process after the temporary license are done, that they would get a permanent license shortly thereafter.
Anything further, Senator Benson, on that?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to – Minnesota has a hard time understanding the skills that you have when you come out of the military, because we don't have, you know, Fort Hood or Fort Campbell. We don't have kind of the culture, and so a lot of employers don't understand the hard and soft skills. And so to the extent that we can give them credit for those hard skills and move them forward in the licensing process, it just – helps them leapfrog back into community service faster.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Senator Benson. I think we've tried to develop a process of recognizing experience, not just for military families, but just a general process of trying to get a handle around certifying or licensing or degrees that give credit for experience in the field. And military has always been an area we thought we could move something with because there was more clarity there than any place else. And that's what I see this is attempting to do. It doesn't go as far as what we tried to do in higher ed, but it certainly is a part of the licensing process. Is there anyone else, do you know of anyone else, Senator Saxauger, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? This would be the time. So I don't see anybody coming forward. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Laurie.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, you said that all of the boards have said that they could accomplish this. Is there a fiscal implication, though, of accommodating it? I don't know if that's been...
Senator Saxhog.
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, I'm not aware of any.
Senator Laurie.
Council is saying there probably is a cost to doing this, but it would be probably covered within the fees collected by that board. Is how it would be accomplished would be my... I mean, we just need clarity to understand where, you know, how it progresses through.
So it will need to go to finance then. Okay.
Well,
okay. It will be going to Education Policy Committee from here.
That's where it's going next, right?
And then from there.
From there, you know, we're just taking this one step at a time.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you've talked with licensing boards. There is not any objection from the boards or concerns about their responsibilities about making certain license holders are safe in the public.
Right.
Senator Saxon?
Madam
You're not
Chair,
aware of
correct.
Any? That's correct.
I'm seeing that the Policy Committee of the Health Licensees Boards suggested their changes, and we made them.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion? All those in favor, as of 1807, as amended, be passed and referred to the Education Policy Committee. That motion can be made by Senator Laurie. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Franzen is presenting Senate File 2187, Healthcare Homes Advisory Committee Establishment. Welcome to the committee, Senator. Please introduce yourself and your testifiers, and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Melissa Franzen, introducing Senate File 2187 regarding healthcare homes. And I do have an amendment if we want to move that first before we go into...
The amendment is the... A1 amendment, it is in your packet. Senator Neenah, now would you offer the A1 amendment?
Yes.
Is there any, it's an author's amendment, so we can go, it's an author's amendment, so typically we accept those. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. A1 amendment passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Healthcare Homes Program was established in 2008 as part of Minnesota's Bipartisan Health Reform Initiative. And the focus of healthcare homes is to provide patient-centered coordinated care for complex patients to make sure that healthcare homes understand how to deliver team-based care and that they're able to effectively manage their population and improve the quality of care they provide. And this is really about putting the patient at the center and making sure that we have a strong voice in shaping care that works for them and their needs. There have been several working groups that have been working on providing input to the work of healthcare homes, and this bill intends to formalize those working groups into an advisory body, and it needs to be done in statute. So that is the main purpose of the bill. There's no cost to the bill. The department can cover these costs out of existing resources, and the advisory board we're talking about would be anywhere from 12 to 14 people. With me today, I have Diane Rydrick, who is able to provide more input for the committee.
Welcome, Ms. Rydrick. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I don't have a whole lot to add to the introduction. I think this is a fairly straightforward bill. As Senator Franzen noted, we've had the healthcare home program, which we administer collaboratively with the Department of Human Services for 5 years now, having consumer voices at the table throughout the process of implementing the program, working with healthcare homes to improve quality, working on payment methods, all of those things. It's really important to us to have consumers and patients at the table. That's been challenging for us. One of the reasons why we want to put this in statute as an advisory body is so that we can guarantee that we have a certain percentage of consumers and patients and family members who are at the table advising us, and that we're able to reimburse them for expenses like travel, costs for attending meetings, which we currently don't have the ability to do. It's a very small amount of money for us that we can manage throughout with our existing resources, but for patients and consumers who want to participate, it's a big deal for them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ryderick. Are there any others who wish to testify on this piece of legislation that are in the audience? Please come forward and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair?
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself,
yes.
Ms. Barzan?
My name is Virginia Barzan. I'm with the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. I'm their executive vice president. We have a membership representing over 3,000 family physicians and medical students. And on their behalf, I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 2187. Our organization has been a strong proponent of establishing patient-centered medical homes throughout Minnesota as an effective way to enhance quality and reduce costs for all patients in Minnesota. Family physicians have played a significant role in the development of healthcare homes in Minnesota, both in their practices and as part of advisory committees and work groups. In fact, the recent report on healthcare homes presented to the legislature showed that 44% of the primary care providers in certified healthcare homes are family physicians. We are pleased to see the success of the program shown in the legislative report, but also think there is much more potential for cost savings and quality improvement. The Healthcare Home Advisory Committee described in this bill could play a significant role in further success of healthcare homes in Minnesota by leading the next phase in development and making modifications that will increase the number of patients who receive care coordination. As the report points out, Minnesota lacks a multi-payer critical mass supporting a common payment methodology. This has posed problems for clinics that have invested in implementation because they need an adequate return on investment to continue to expand their efforts to a broader base of patients. We are pleased to still see that the advisory committee would provide advice to the commissioners on statewide solutions for engagement of employers and commercial payers. This is a key step to increase the spread of care coordination throughout the state. We support Senate File 2187 and would encourage our members to be actively involved in the advisory process. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Barzan. Are there any questions from the committee for our testifiers? And Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Ryderick, it's good to get the update from both testifier and yourself about how well the healthcare homes are doing. And it's just to the discretion of the department, who's going to be sitting on that and the percentage of consumers versus providers. Did I hear you correctly?
Ms. Ryderich?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. We've laid out a framework here of the types of organizations and individuals who we would want to have on the group. We wanted to specify a minimum percentage that would be patients or consumers, and I believe it's 25% as a minimum. Often what happens with advisory bodies is you'll have one person who sort of is charged with being a token representative of a particular group or a population, so we wanted to make sure we didn't get in that position, and we had enough people there to give a broader representation of patient needs.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you. I'd like to move Senate File 2187 be recommended to pass and
As amended. And considered for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy bill.
That's what I was going to say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm getting it down. All right. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Senator Hoffman here. Senator Clausen, I saw you sitting there a little bit. There you are. Senator Clausen is presenting Senate File 2309, Local Public Health System Provisions and Modifications.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to meet with you and present Senate File 2309, the Local Public Health Act. And this act will provide the foundation and organizing framework for Minnesota's local public health system. The Local Public Health Act was passed in 1976, and Senate File 2309 clarifies public health responsibilities. It eliminates unnecessary and obsolete language and aligns the statute with current public health practices. The proposed changes were developed by the Minnesota Department of Health in partnership with local government representation. With us today from the Minnesota Department of Health is Ms. Debbie Burns, Director of the Office of Health Performance Improvement. Also providing testimony is Mr. Peter Giesen, representing the Local Public Health Association. Ms. Burns.
Thank you. Hello, Ms. Burns. Please introduce yourself and your organization and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Deb Burns. I'm the Director of the Office of Performance Improvement at the Minnesota Department of Health. As Senator Clausen mentioned, Chapter 145A provides the framework for our state and local governmental public health partnership and local public health system. When this law was passed, it was really quite revolutionary for its time. It created a framework where local governments voluntarily organized from having over 2,000 local health jurisdictions in Minnesota to 50-some with a financial incentive to do that. It also had provisions for communication and coordination between state and local governments on public health. And it outlines the commissioner's responsibilities to help and support local health departments. It also created this really unique advisory body called the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, and it's one representative of each of the 50 community health boards that comes together with the Commissioner of Health and key staff to develop a consensus on public health issues. And I mention that because it was a work group of that body that developed Senate File 2309, the proposal that you see before you today. The work group went about its work very thoughtfully and took over a year to actually examine all the parts of the law. And it was done really to make sure that the public health system remains strong in the future. The principles that they looked at were, one, keep what works, because there's a lot that actually works quite well in the law. The second is to align the statute with current public health practice. It's in the time since the act was passed, the world has changed quite a bit, and so there were things that were quite outdated. And then to reduce duplication and clearly define local responsibilities, the law, it was somewhat confusing at times. So just to give you a very high-level overview of the changes, sections 1 through 8 add or update definitions. 9 through 13, and then scattered throughout much of the rest of the bill, are that they were rewritten to really clean up the language. There was legacy language related to boards of health, which were the 2,000 local health jurisdictions that remained, and it was very confusing because there were two sets of commissioners' duties throughout the law. Section 14 on page 6 is the duties of community health boards. That was substantially rewritten to make the local responsibilities clear. Again, there was a lack of clarity in those. And then one duty was added, and that was to implement a performance management process. And that was to assure continuous improvement, that our system continues to evolve and we look at how we're doing things so that we can make the best use of resources. A parallel requirement was added for the Commissioner of Health in Section 20, and that's to look at this from a statewide perspective, again, to look at where there are strengths and weaknesses and how we can improve. And then Section 27 on page 18, the accountability language for the local public health block grant was rewritten and simplified, and an appeals process was added. So in closing, I'd like to just make two comments. One is that when this law was passed, it was really quite revolutionary, and a lot of other states have looked to us to create a system like we have in Minnesota for public health. This bill, Senate File 2309, is really evolutionary. And then also the changes in Senate File 2309 were not only developed with our local partners, but they were taken around the state for discussion with local public health leaders around the state. They're supported by this advisory body that I mentioned, the State Community Health Services Advisory Community Health Services Advisory Committee. They're supported by the Local Public Health Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the Minnesota Public Health Association. So thank you, Madam Chair and Senator.
Thank you very much. Ms. Burns, Mr. Giesen, are you from Olmsted County and wanting to testify to this bill as well?
Madam Chair, yes. Yes, please.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 2309. My name is Pete Giesen. I am Director of Olmsted County Public Health. I'm also the Chair-elect for the Local Public Health Association, and I'm here today on behalf of city, county, and tribal public health department leaders across the state who identified strengthening and streamlining the Local Public Health Act as a top priority for 2014. As co-chair of the Chapter 145 work group convened by the State Health Department, I can personally attest to the iterative and collaborative process that was undertaken in formulating the proposed changes. We had a great deal of discussion and partnered closely with the department staff on these updates for over a year. As mentioned, Local Public Health Association also played a role in outreach and many other local government affiliates, such as the Association of Minnesota Counties, which have either endorsed the outlined changes or expressed no concerns. Local Public Health Association is pleased that the resulting bill will simplify and clarify the public health responsibilities that we are charged to fulfill locally, especially by defining our six core service areas or areas of public health responsibility. We'll also codify the important work we are already doing with the Minnesota Department of Health to engage in performance management and achieve and work towards continuous improvement. And finally, it will remove duplicative and confusing and obsolete language, among other things. Chapter 145A governs day-to-day local public health practice. Maintaining a statute that is clear, up-to-date, and fully functional ensures we are able to meet the highest expectations for local performance, deliver meaningful service to the clients in our communities, and build on a strong state-local partnership we have all come to value. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Giesen. Are there any questions for our testifiers at this time? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, not about the bill, but I'm just curious about the names of some of these local public health organizations. Quinn County? How would they come up with a name like that? I've never heard of it. I'm not that part of the state, obviously.
Ms. Burns, we expect you to be an authority on that.
Yes.
Deb Burns, Minnesota Department of Health. I can't speak to how they came up with the name, but Quinn does represent the number of counties that are involved in that community health board.
Are there any other questions? Are there any others who wish to testify on this Senate file 2309? Please come forward. I saw someone stand there. I'm not sure if they are just standing or coming forward. Just standing. Okay, great. So seeing no one else wanting to testify and there are no further questions, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 2309, Local Public Health System Provision Modifications.
Was there an amendment?
And this has been referred to state and local government. All right. Any further discussion? I guess I need to add that this language will also be considered in, and this is included in Senator Hayden's motion, in our omnibus policy bill. Thank you very much. Senator Hayden, Senate File 2309, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Come on back anytime. Okay, Senate File 2240, Senator Hoffman's presenting the North Star Care for Children Program Modifications, Children and Family Service Provision Modifications. Welcome, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 2240 is the Children and Family Services Policy Bill. This bill amends, clarifies, and makes technical corrections to programs that within the Children and Family Services Administration at the Department of Human Services. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the author's amendment A3 at this time. I think it should be being passed out from our...
It's in our packet, so this is a... Is this a delete-all amendment?
No, Madam Chair, it is not. There was three amendments that were added for clarification and consistency to conform with Title 4E of the Federal Foster Care Act, which is under the Social Security Administration. So this just clarifies and gets everything.
Okay, thank you very much. That's the A3 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, the A3 amendment's being offered as an author's amendment by Senator Hoffman. Any further discussion or questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
This bill contains a series of technical corrections for the North Star Care for Children program. It repeals the housing ratio for Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance recipients and corrects an oversight in the group residential housing program due to licensing changes last session. And I'll quickly go through these, Madam Chair. Article 1 contains a series of technical corrections for North Star Care for Children. It highlights the legislature passed North Star Care for Children last session. Effective January 1st, 2015, North Star Care unifies benefits for children in foster care, relative care, and adoption homes. And then the third point is it will eliminate a major barrier that has interfered with children in foster care who can't be returned home from acquiring new permanent families. The second point is most of the corrections being brought here are coming into compliance with, as I said earlier, the Title 4E regulations that are there. And the rest of the corrections streamline processes, reduce duplication, then add the legal references or clarifying language. That is also inclusive, Madam Chair, of tribal and county agency practices. That's Article 1. Article 2, background is the supplemental aid is an income supplement for people who receive or are eligible for the federal supplemental security income benefits through Social Security. Special needs payments can be authorized for some housing costs on certain situations. And then the section strikes language that limits the number of people receiving the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing. That was formerly called Shelter Needy, to no more than 25% of people living in a building. We're asking for some flexibility. Eliminating the ratio restrictions provides greater housing opportunities for people leaving institutions, facilities, or homelessness. And, Madam Chair, it is consistent with the Minnesota Olmstead Plan and Minnesota's plan to prevent and end homelessness. And finally, it eliminates the ratio restrictions that for people with disabilities, where it actually gives them a choice. That's consistency with Olmstead Act, a choice where they live and whom they live with, and reduces the administrative burden for counties in determining eligibility. Article 2, Section 2 is the group residential housing license correction, and there is a background piece on that. Is a group residential housing is a state-funded room and board payment for low-income disabled individuals. The second part of that is the group residential housing statute includes the new community residential license for some adult foster care statute. That's 245D, which, of course, was passed a couple years ago, and as an allowable license for group residential. That's basically in a nutshell, Madam Chair. I do have with me individuals from the program, and you know what? I just totally lost my piece of paper that had their.
That's
full
just
name,
fine. So. I know that we have
thank you.
John Sellen and Jane Lawrence with us, and you could introduce yourself, and I would appreciate it that if there's something that you need to add to what Senator Hoffman was saying that would clarify the bill, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, members, my name is John Sellen. I'm a Human Services Area Manager at Hennepin County, and I'm project lead.
Yeah, I'll pull it forward.
You almost have to swallow it in order to be heard. So.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, my name is John Sellen. I'm Human Services Area Manager at Hennepin County, and I'm project lead at the Department of Human Services on North Star Care for Children. Before you, Article 1 deals with a series of technical corrections, as Senator Hoffman indicated, to North Star Care that was passed last session. Most of these involve bringing North Star Care into compliance with federal requirements so that we can earn the Title IV-E funding. Included in this are adding federally required background study requirements. That's in Sections 1, 2, and 8. Providing a federally required optional transition for a child who is in relative care to be able to move to adoption. Adoption is the federally preferred option, and so there has to be a door open to that for any child who's in relative care. That's in Section 13. Third, there's federally required reasonable efforts, assurances, and reviews. These are being added to the out-of-home placement plan and also to court proceedings when a child is moving for a custody transfer of physical and legal custody or for adoption. This is in Sections 10, 22, and 23. It also brings federal compliance for eligibility for the kinship guardianship assistance, dealing with licensing of foster parents, and dealing with eliminating an unneeded at-risk status and payment for kinship, guardianship, assistance, and adoption. This is accomplished in Sections 9, 17, 18, 19, and 26. The rest of them are a series of things that we've learned in dealing with stakeholder groups. They streamline processes. They reduce duplication. They add legal references or clarifying language that are inclusive of tribal practice. First, there's a series of things that clarify eligibility to be inclusive of tribal and county agency practice. This is in Sections 6, 7, and 12. It streamlines the uniform assessment process and the reimbursement process for relative custody assistance to make them more efficient. This is in Sections 15, 16, and 21. Adds a legal cross-reference, North Star Care for Children, in the Medical Assistance Act. This is in Section 5. It changes the component's name from guardianship assistance, which was the federal term, but is confusing in Minnesota law since guardianship is used in a number of ways in Minnesota law. So we're changing that to kinship assistance instead. That's in Section 25. Clarifies the local share to ensure parallel construction with neighboring provisions. This is in Section 20. And finally, it eliminates time-consuming, redundant processes when the caregiver is already has a foster care license, eliminates all the duplications of that process for approval for adoption or for transfer of custody. This is in Sections 3, 4, 11, 14, and 24.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Jane Lorenz with Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm a manager with the Community Living Supports Unit. I think Senator Hoffman summarized Article 2, Section 1, and Section 2 pretty well. Repealing the MSA racial restriction will allow persons with disabilities to have more choice and options when looking for housing. And then for the GRH, the group residential housing, to make that conform with 245D, it just allows payments to continue for persons that are in adult foster homes that have the license, the new community residence license. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. Is there anyone else? Would anybody like to ask questions of these testifiers at this time? Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard? Well done, Senator Hoffman and testifiers. Well done. Then our motion, Senator Hoffman, is that Senate File 2240 be referred, as amended, pass and be referred to Judiciary Committee.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And that is the motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much. Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen presents Senate File 2134, Prescription Monitoring Program Modifications. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. First off, Madam Chair, I have an amendment, the A1 amendment I'd like to move.
The Senator offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, this is just allows the DHS to access electronic information from the methadone clinics. But the prescription monitoring program bill, which was used to be called the Controlled Substance Prescription Electronic Reporting System, is now the Prescription Monitoring Program. And as you know, members, the prescription drugs are now the second most abused drug in Minnesota next to marijuana. The abuse of the opiate pain relievers such as oxycodone and hydrocodone is acute. So in 2012, the department, along with nine other agencies and departments, came up with the Minnesota State Substance Abuse Strategy document. And one of their immediate primary recommendations was to, quote, accelerate efforts to increase participation by prescribers and pharmacists in the prescription monitoring program and examine alternate methods for law enforcement access. There are several changes, and Madam Chair and members, if you remember correctly, we did have this bill in front of us last year. We did pass it through. We made some recommendations. This bill has since then changed a little bit. It is from the board. And it is a priority, actually. I should go back to the 2013 National Governors Association has included this as part of their six strategies for reducing prescription drug abuse. So it obviously is a huge priority. If I could just go through some of the differences from last year's bill, Senate File 1081, to this year's bill, Senate File 2134. It exempts for a licensed pharmacy located on the premise of a residential hospice from reporting dispensing activities to the PMPs, since those prescriptions dispensed are done so for the patients who reside in the hospice. This is similar, which last year we passed it for long-term care facilities. So this would be for the hospice. It changes the advisory committee to a task force to ensure the critical group's existence does not expire. It includes a provision that will allow the board to review the data in the database to identify individuals who fit the criteria, which is established by the board in consultation with the Prescription Monitoring Program Advisory Task Force, which may indicate or show a red flag of doctor shopping. Currently, there are 42 of the 49 states with PMPs that have authority to conduct this process, and 30 of those states are actively producing their own reports. It also, last year's version included a provision to keep data for purposes of administrating and operating of the system. So this data, the retention time limit was not established last year. We have a time limit of no more than 5 years is added. It includes a provision that will allow a specific health-related licensing boards and the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board to access the data under certain circumstances. The access will be by way of a written report presented to the PMP staff, which would in turn access the system to produce a report. It includes a provision that will allow personnel of the Health Professional Services Program to access the data for an individual currently enrolled in their program, with the provision that they will not disclose that information to the health-related licensing board or the EMS or the Emergency Regulatory Board, except as permitted by law. This access would be by way of a written request presented to the PMP staff, which in turn will access the system to produce a report. And it also, the report has received numerous requests for de-identified PMP data, which has not been unable to, which they have been unable to release the information to date. This provision will allow for a release of de-identified data for public research, policy, and education purposes. That's line 8.4 through 8.6. With that, Madam Chair and members, I have Ms. Barb Carter and Dr. Cody Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy that could go into further details about this bill. Personally, I think it should have gone a little farther, just as far as prescription monitoring. I know is the single biggest fact we could do to get control of our prescription drug abuse in the state, but it's a good start. I think it's got very good reviews. There probably is some data issues that I think Mr. Neumeister is going to come up and talk about, which are no different than what the bill that we passed, I believe, last year. So with that, I will turn it over to either Dr. Weiberg or Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. But just to clarify, this bill did pass through and just did not get heard on the floor of the Senate, correct? And with some modifications that you've identified here.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you. Who would like to begin?
Madam Chair, please
introduce yourself?
Thank you. My name is Barb Carter, and I manage the prescription monitoring program at the Board of Pharmacy. And just to build a little bit on what Senator Rosen has said, again, this bill actually was put together by the advisory committee. We vetted it with the members of that committee, and we felt that we put together a pretty comprehensive package of information and details then that would allow the prescription monitoring program to increase its effectiveness throughout the community. There's four areas I'd like to touch on that were in last year's bill but really have been identified as important areas for change. One of them would be the requirement, well, currently I should say the prescription monitoring program collects data on controlled substance schedules 2 through 4. The change that we're looking for will also require that anything that's considered a scheduled 5 controlled substance, as well as the tramadol and butalbital prescriptions, are reported to the system as well. We have received feedback from several prescribers, pharmacists out in the community who have indicated that tramadol right now is really one of their primary concerns of abuse. So we're trying to be responsive to those requests. In addition, currently the law allows for prescribers to access the data only when checking on a current patient that they're prescribing or considering prescribing a controlled substance for. Once again, we've listened to the community out there who utilizes the system, and they have indicated that it would be their preference to be able to utilize the data whenever there's other medical treatment that might prove necessary for access to the data. For example, in the emergency room, if an individual comes in, they're unconscious, maybe they're given some naloxone, they come to, but they're still a little bit out of it, and nobody can really figure out what they're taking. It might be to the advantage of the emergency room doctor to be able to check the PMP to identify what that individual might have taken. Additionally, a pharmacist can currently access the data when they're dispensing or considering dispensing. And as Dr. Weiberg might point out, the role of a pharmacist is more than just dispensing or considering dispensing. They also provide some other pharmaceutical care to their patients. And so, again, they find it would be necessary or would be helpful if they could access the data whenever they're providing pharmaceutical care to their clients as well. And then the very last provision I think that's critical is that currently the law does not allow for a prescriber's name to be present on the report unless that prescriber has given permission to the PMP to release. And again, the users of the system, the stakeholders out there in the community, have indicated that it would be much more valuable if they knew who the prescriber was for a particular prescription in case they wanted to make a phone call to check to see what might be going on and to consult with those other prescribers who are prescribing controlled substances as well. With that, do you have any questions?
We can have some questions of this testifier at this time. Not right away. So I think that to supplement that testimony, would you like to begin, Mr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy.
Swallow your microphone if you wouldn't mind.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. And I think Senator Rosen and Ms. Carter have actually covered the bill quite well. I just want to add just a couple observations. Some of you may know that between my role now and my role with the Department of Human Services as the pharmacy program manager, I've been doing this sort of thing for about 15 years. And I can just tell you that this particular piece of legislation is the most vetted piece of legislation that I have ever worked on. It has gone before our advisory committee, now to be an advisory task force, about a half a dozen times. In addition, unlike a cabinet-level agency where a commissioner might be able to approve a bill, as chief administrative officer, I can't do that. I have to take this before the full board at public meetings. And so the board itself has taken testimony on this bill at a number of different public meetings. We've done a lot of work with professional associations, and we've made some changes here. So this is one of the most vetted pieces of legislation, I think, that I've ever worked on. The other thing, she didn't really mention it, but I had Ms. Carter do a admittedly unscientific survey. We have a contract with the entity known as SurveyMonkey, where you can do web-based surveys. And we did a survey of the prescribers and the pharmacists that use this system. And as of when I saw the data, we had over 1,000 prescribers respond and over 700 pharmacists. And they overwhelmingly support those four provisions that Ms. Carter emphasized. And I'm talking in the range of 85 to 90% support for making those changes. So really, that's just all I wanted to emphasize.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Are there any questions at this time for our testifiers? Seeing none, then I would like to ask Rich Neumeister to approach. He would like to testify. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister.
Rich, I'm asking everybody to really pull that up because we're having trouble hearing you
here.
For
the record, my name is Rich Neumeister, and just as a courtesy to let you know, I've been a member of the advisory board since its inception several years, and I am basically the privacy consumer kind of person. There's a couple consumers, but I come with a very strong privacy interest. And secondly, sometimes I'm outvoted many times. That's why, thank God, we still have a legislature.
Are you indicating that you're here because you were outvoted again in the committee?
Yeah. I mean, they're every year, and I have to quite say what Cody Weiberg was saying. It's a very open, participatory, granted, you know, certain more interest parties than others, but it's been a very open and drafts and all those kinds of things.
Well, I appreciate that, and I was just kidding, but the committee is seriously wants to hear what you have to
right.
say.
Let's head on to page 4, lines 430 through 432. One has to go back as to why we started doing this in the first place a number of years ago, and some of aspects of why they wanted to have prescription monitoring databases was not just to see people who are doctor shopping, but also to see whether doctors are overprescribing. And it varies in state to state whether or not there is an active role in using the PMP, which we call this, to see how doctors are doing. And I think that's one of the elements that we need to take a look at. One of the reasons why that did not get in originally, as it has done in some states, that aspect of it, because there's a strong interest of folks, of lobbyists, and interest in the medical profession here, and they were able to make the case. So, Madam Chair, I think that's an important thing to look at, and I just share that because it highlights it, again, with this new language. But it relates, then, to a study that you're doing. If you go back to Section 2 and you're going to do a study about the prescription monitoring program database, why don't you just take a look at what other states are doing to see how it's being used to see if doctors are overprescribing, are maybe some of the elements that are relating to the prescription or the pain epidemic that's happening across the country and here in Minnesota. So I just want to encourage, I think they're, you know, I've had conversations with folks about that before within the Board of Pharmacy, but I think that's something at least you may want to take a look at. The other item is on starting on 436, going over through 5-7. You've got to remember, right now there's approximately 6 million records on about a million people. Currently, they destroy the data. It's all identified. It's all prescription data, basically, with drug, with prescription 1 through 5 and other kinds of drugs being added on individuals here in Minnesota. So now they're asking to keep it for another 5 years, identified. I believe that if they're going to keep it identified, it should be de-identified. Again, I have always seen, and I've taken close attention to this particular one, because this was a database that grew small, had very limited access, but as time has gone on, there's more and more people wanting to get access. So when you create longer periods of time for data, people are going to be more inclined to want to have access to that data. Here it's going to be only limited for research purposes under the Board of Pharmacy, but I think it should be de-identified. And I even throw in, do they really need it for 5 years? You go on down to 533 to 536. And it continues on to 6-2. One of the things that, as policymakers, you have to ask yourselves, on one hand, you believe in consent. You believe that when data, very private, sensitive data on individuals, are given to another agency, that they should be informed, at least, either through a consent process or a notice process. And what you're doing here is you're basically allowing health board agencies access to the data without possibly no notice, no due process, or not even consent. Again, I share that with you. I would prefer what I just enunciated, a consent or some kind of thing, and it can be done. The other aspect of this is now going down to lines 624 through 629. I've had this discussion again with Mr. Weiberg, Cody Weiberg, and Ms. Carter and folks of the board. Again, we ask ourselves, well, let's just let them have access to it. Again, where's the consent? Yes, they do a written request for it, but is it done with request? Consent, or even the person who participates in this kind of program, you know, for treatment or whatever, that is even a condition of, you know, that you say to them, hey, you want to be, you know, you want to get your license back, you want to be, you know, do some good work, a rehab, or a, well, we're going to need access to the PMP to sort of make sure that you're on the straight and focused rather than unfocused. It takes a simple consent. Now, the other item is when we talk about where the information can be going to other states. This is where North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, whatever, and in the long run, probably a national database, which has been talked about, be shared. I don't know too many details yet about this, and hopefully as this bill moves forward, which, Madam Chair, I think will go to the committee that you currently sit on, Judiciary, if that's the case, then maybe, you know, that the issue could be addressed there. So, Madam Chair and members of the Policy Health Services Policy Committee, those are my concerns, and they come just from a perspective about how information flows and accountability, and just trying to focus you all to take a look at some of these kinds of policies that you do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. That's Mr. Neumeister and Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just like to thank Mr. Neumeister for sitting on the advisory committee and doing due diligence. You've contributed a lot, and may not always agree with you, but I do appreciate you.
At least I'm not called a pain sometimes around here by some. But anyway, thank you very much. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Any questions in general about the bill? I would like to afford you the opportunity, Mr. Weiberg or Senator Rosen. You know, Mr. Neumeister asks the question about why didn't we not go further in terms of, and what are the issues, you know, some of the issues that come up about this growing problem of prescription monitoring because of the problems that are occurring around Schedule II narcotics becoming the gateway into heroin. Why aren't we looking at the prescriber's prescribing behavior? Other debates that we've had in other bills about prescribers could be resolved if we had that portion in this bill. So what continues to create the problem for us to get at that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are at least a couple of issues that I could highlight here. First of all, Mr. Neumeister sort of implied that we might not be going down that road because of lobbying by professional associations. I do think you'd find that some of the professional associations of prescribers would have concerns about this, but I was asked to work on this program by Senator Berglund way back in 2005. And after I left her office, the first thing I wrote when I got back to my office and started my notes about how to approach this, my number one concern was if we don't do it right, we're going to have a chilling effect on legitimate prescribing. And so when you're talking about controlled substances in general, and I think opiate pain relievers in particular, you're talking about what I think is a delicate balance between trying to make sure people don't abuse them, but trying to make sure that people who really need them have access to them. So one of the concerns that there is, and this isn't shared universally, Mr. Neumeister is correct, in some states there is an ability to look at prescribing practices. And I've got an idea about maybe amending the study section of our language to take a look at what other states are doing. But many of us who are involved in this feel that if you use the system and people, prescribers are aware that there might be almost just unfettered access to the system just to look at possible prescribing problems, that they would be less likely to prescribe controlled substances, even though they might be really needed. So that's one concern. Now, the other concern I can just relate to is the Board of Medical Practice itself, not the Medical Association, the Board of Medical Practice had very big concerns about this bill when it was initially introduced. That language that does not allow the boards that license prescribers to look at the data for the purpose of judging prescribing practices was actually put in at the request of the Board of Medical Practice. That's because they had experience sometime before I was at the board, so 10 or more years ago, they had an experience with some other program where they were getting these reports about possible misprescribing, and they said that they had a lot of reports, they had to do a lot of work, and they had to dismiss most of these complaints. They actually found very little evidence that there was inappropriate prescribing. And so there is some history in this state looking at this, and then there's that concern. But getting to the study right now would direct the board in Section 2, would direct a board to look at what other states are doing in terms of requiring prescribers and pharmacists to actually use the database. We could potentially add language to have the board study what other states are doing in terms of having prescribers' prescribing patterns looked at as well.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. I would really appreciate that additional language at a minimum. In other conversations, trying to figure out how to deal with over-prescribing or misprescribing or being the gateway into heroin through the prescriptive process is better managed by tracking prescribing patterns than by restricting people's access to healthcare providers who can provide appropriate treatment with medication. So we're just getting off onto the wrong solution when you start restricting the provider's ability to provide the medication when what we could do, which is really track of all the prescribers, is their prescribing difficulty if we would include that in this bill. So I am interested in understanding what other states are doing about that because I think that's really where the reform can occur as it relates to the practice of prescribing or writing scripts. Senator Rosen, you wanted to speak to this?
Bingo, Madam Chair. I think you hit it. It's a very delicate balance to make sure that we get this right. And the conversations that I have had with especially MMA about continuing ed credits on their prescription methods. I believe that the industry is on a educational push to make sure that their body understands the importance of this. They do not want to have any more continuing ed requirements put on them, but there is a delicate balance here. We do obviously have it from the prescribing end, but you also don't want to tie their hands on the relief for these individuals also.
Senator Weiberg, or excuse me, I'm sorry to demote you. Mr. Weiberg.
Yeah. Interestingly, when I was in the last House committee, they called me representative, too. Maybe there's something in my future I'm not aware of. Actually, I hope not. I just wanted to say just one clarification. There's really nothing in the way that the program runs now or anything that we're proposing that in any way limits access of individuals to go to providers. Providers, prescribers, for example, are not even required to look at the data, which is what we're studying, because we certainly got the message from a number of senators and representatives in both parties to take a look at requiring use of the program. But nothing in the way the program runs now creates any sort of access issue for people. The other thing I would just point out, just a real quick personal example about that builds on the fact that I think the industry and both this would be both the pharmacies and the prescribers are actually taking actions themselves. Very personal story. My wife and I were in Dublin in January. She tripped, fell, had a major fracture, a four-part fracture of her humeral head, had surgery to reconstruct it there, came home with a plate and six pins and artificial bone. We came home on a flight on Friday, just 3 days after the surgery. They had given us enough of regular-release oxycodone to get her through the flight. We went into our local clinic, which was part of a major healthcare system in the state, and we were told by the physician's assistant, because even though we'd been going to that clinic for over 20 years, because the surgery wasn't done by a surgeon in that system, the most they would prescribe was 3 days' worth. And that was a new policy they just put in place. And pharmacies, some of the major chains, because they have been fined in the tune of tens of millions of dollars by the DEA, have put policies in place so that pharmacists have to check the PMP. They have to call prescribers when they have certain questions. So I actually think there is a lot being done by both the profession of pharmacy and by prescribers in healthcare systems to look at potential inappropriate prescribing that's in dispensing.
Thank you. Then the final thing that I'd ask you to speak to briefly is the issue of consent. You've had the discussion on consent, obviously, in your committee. So you've chosen not to require consent. I thought you might want to speak and help us understand your position on that concern.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think Mr. Neumeister is talking about the proposal to allow the other health licensing boards and HPSP to access the data. To request the data from our board. They're not going to have direct access to request the data from our board in certain circumstances. What the language talks about is that the health licensing boards would have to be acting on a specific complaint that they have received that alleges that their licensee or registrant has engaged in doctor shopping or writing fraudulent prescriptions. That's the only sort of complaint where they could request the data. And Mr. Neumeister mentioned, well, we don't even know if there's due process. In fact, there is. The health licensing boards under Chapter 214 and Chapter 14 have numerous due process procedures in place that we have to follow whenever we're investigating a complaint or disciplining someone. So there actually is ample ability for people to have due process. In regards to HPSP, that data would not be actually reported back to the health licensing boards unless the person was unsatisfactorily discharged from the program at any rate, in which case the boards are going to treat that as a complaint, and that would kick the due process provisions into place again.
Are there any other questions for our testifiers on this bill?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
I was just looking for some help in the background because I was just thinking about the community paramedic bill that we passed out of this body and is signed into law. That's a provision where the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board should have access to that information to make sure that you do truly live within that continuum of care and all everybody is moving in the same direction for that patient. So I was just conferring with Dr. Weiberg on that, but that's where you would want to see that collaboration.
Thank you. My interest, I'm very interested in seeing us have a very strong capacity to be able to address this in its appropriate place, not by restricting access to providers, but by addressing the issue through these processes that you're talking about.
And Madam Chair, I mentioned earlier, I personally would have liked to see a little more than just a study, but I understand that this has been around a long time. We are going to get it right this time. In reference to your concerns, too. And whenever you're dealing with data, it's always a little touchy. So we want to make sure that we get this right, and that's why I believe the department went with, or the board went with a study.
In fact, just I think the last comment I have, unless other questions come up, the other reason we want to do this study about requiring the use is although a number of states have language that require use, when you look behind the language a little bit, you'll see that there most states have all sorts of exceptions built into it. You have to use a system except, and then there's a bunch of things listed. And there are some, we would be a state right now listed as requiring use, and that's only because the legislature last year passed a provision requiring the medical directors at methadone treatment facilities to use it. So we want to take a really close look at what other states are doing and see what's worked and what hasn't worked, because this whole concept of requiring use is very new. Very few states have been doing this for more than 2 or 3 years. And so we do want to make sure we get it absolutely right before we go down that path here.
And it's not just requiring use by the prescriber, but the other portion that I heard Mr. Neumeister talking about is studying what the states are doing in terms of being able to use the data to look at the prescriber's prescribing pattern.
Madam Chair, that's not in this language, but we would.
You're talking about adding that.
To add that if
yeah. And I'd be looking forward to that. And I'm saying that because I understand there's resistance from the current prescribers to doing this, but if there's concern by the prescribers about abuse of these chemicals, then there ought to be some initiative other than restricting prescribers, because that's not going to change the pattern that's in place right now. Okay, thank you. Senator Laurie.
Madam Chair, and I guess I'd just like, I hesitate to bring this up a little bit because we spent quite a bit of time on it, but in regards to the statements about HPSP not reporting to the board, I think that is a correct analysis of the way the world works today, but we did have a bill up earlier that may well change that reporting, and some of the things found by HPSP in this investigation could be considered diversion. And according to the bill that passed out of this committee a couple of weeks ago, it actually would be reportable to the boards then as well. So that clarification of that statement that it was in regards to the law as it stands today, but there's another proposal that would interact with that and possibly change that dynamic.
Correct.
If I'm correct in that assessment.
Okay. Yes, that's correct. That is correct. And without consent language, I don't think there's any consent language, which is the issue here.
Madam Chair, there's been many of you, and I appreciate all your work on this issue. This has been around a long time, and Senator Laurie.
And that bill that Senator Laurie is talking about is in judiciary, where we'll be discussing these similar issues, primary issues there.
With that, then?
Okay, very good. With that, Senator Rosen, your motion is, let me see if I've got it here.
I move that Senate File 2134, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to judiciary. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
No, this is not. Let me just hold on for a second. So it's going to go down. Can we change the motion now? Change the motion. Keep considering. I think so. Excuse me, Senator. Have you seen Senator? Oh, yeah. I thought somebody told me he was there. Okay. Excuse me. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. This is Senate File 2135. It's the Board of Pharmacy General Policy Bill. And, Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment I'd like to move first.
Senator Rosen offers the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed, say nay. Adopted.
Basically, Madam Chair, members, this the A1 amendment conforms the language to federal guidelines. And last year, we also had this language in the bill. That was one bill. We have split the PMP off from the general policy bill, and we're just making sure that it's in the general policy bill. So that's what that amendment was about. So there's four main sections to this bill. There's compounding and manufacturing, the synthetic designer drug section, the pharmacist immunization, and the disciplinary provision. In the compounding and manufacturing, in 2013, we passed legislation in response to a major incident that involved a shipment of contaminated compounded drug product into Minnesota and other states. So far, there's been 60 deaths and 750 cases of fungal infections because of that contaminated product. So the Congress passed the Drug Quality and Security Act in late of 2013. This bill, the 2135, better aligns the state law with this new federal law. And in Section 1, and I won't go through the sections, Section 1, it clarifies the definition. In Section 9 for compounding and manufacturing, it creates a state equivalent of Section 503A of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which exempts the pharmacies and pharmacists that prepare compounded products from the requirement to be a licensed drug manufacturer. And Section 10 creates a state licensing requirement for outsourcing facilities, which will be regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under the Drug Quality and Security Act, which is consistent requirement for any facility that's shipping into Minnesota. The second part of this bill is the synthetic designer drug part, which is all under the Sections 151, Statute 151. So it the board's been very, very involved in this for several years, and these designer drugs are continuing to be sold in retail establishments across the state. So the board worked with the AG's office to develop language that would, number one, modify the definition of drug and clarify that products containing synthetic drugs are subject to prohibitions on the sale of misbranded and unadulterated drugs. It also grants the board the authority to issue cease and desist orders and can be, reviewed by an administrative law judge. It modifies the exceptions in Section 152.26 so they do not apply to the sale of designer products. It prohibits the sale of designer drugs and makes permanent the board's authority to use expedited rulemaking process to add drugs to Schedule 1 if criteria is met. Also, in Section 20, it's adding several drugs to Schedule 1 that have been of great concern to the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, to law enforcement, and to county prosecutors. The third portion of this bill is the pharmacist immunization, which the board worked with MDH, which allows the pharmacist to administer vaccinations. It basically expands the type of practitioner, which will then expand our access to immunization services. It also provides guidance on protocol requirements and sets a best practice standards. It changes training requirements for pharmacists who would want to administer the vaccines. Then the pharmacist would report to the Minnesota Immunization Information Connection rather than directly to the primary doctor or clinic. And it would, again, use the best practice standard that's set by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice. And then the fourth portion of this bill is a disciplinary provision, which the board completely updated the disciplinary action, which imposes a imposed on licensee or registrants, which was very antiquated and not consistent at all, and some of it dates back to like 1947 or something. And it was modeled after the Medical Practice Act, which was reviewed by the AG's office. So with that, again, Madam Chair and members, I have Dr. Weiberg here who can answer any questions or clarify anything that I missed.
Thank you. Would you like to add to Senator Rosen's testimony at this time, Mr. Weiberg?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just very briefly, just wanted to emphasize with the compounding and manufacturing, there were some issues last year that some associations of physicians and other prescribers actually had, and we've worked very closely with them to address their concerns while still having this language compliant with the new federal law. Don't think there are any of the concerns that you may have heard last year from some of the professional associations. Just want to emphasize again that the language on synthetic drugs that grants the board cease and desist authority, this is actually language that was recommended to us by the Attorney General's office and actually worked with one of the assistant AGs assigned to work on this by the Attorney General herself. And the board does completely support this language. Pharmacist immunizations, just want to clarify, pharmacists have had the ability to give immunizations actually for quite some time. But until about 3 or 4 years ago when the large chains started requiring all of their pharmacists to do immunizations, actually very few pharmacists did immunizations. Once the large chains started requiring all their pharmacists to do it, both the health department, which looks at facilities that provide immunizations, and the board, through our inspectors that go out and inspect pharmacies, started noticing some issues. Now, the vast majority of pharmacists, I think, do an excellent job, but one of the sayings I have about the Board of Pharmacy in general is we don't exist for the 98% of the people who did things right. It's that small percentage that don't. And so really what this does, we worked again for 2 or 3 years with the health department getting this language, we think, right, is it just puts into statute what we believe pharmacists, or frankly anyone that does immunizations, the sort of standards they should be following anyway. So it doesn't really add to the ability of pharmacists to do immunizations. They can do that. It just puts into statute the standards we think they should follow. And then I just want to reiterate what Senator Rosen said. Yes, the board has no intention necessarily to do more discipline, but we've been advised by the assistant AG that works with us for 2 or 3 years to really update our language. Just as one example, Senator Rosen almost got it right. The grounds for disciplinary action in our chapter, actually most of them date to 1941. And there have been no changes to the disciplinary sections in over a decade. So this is the one thing we think sort of fits with that unsessioned idea of trying to clear up old obsolete language, or at least bring it into this millennium.
Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Are there any questions for our testifiers? Seeing none, our motion will be, or is there anyone else in the public? Excuse me. Anybody else wishing to testify? Seeing no one, our motion is, we are moving that this Senate File 2135 as amended be passed and referred to the Judiciary Committee. Well, that's the motion, Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, may I ask why the Judiciary Committee? Oh, Madam Chair, because it's synthetic drugs. Yeah.
I think it was requested, so it's on the synthetic drugs. Thank you. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The bill passes as amended. Thank you very much, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
That concludes our hearing for this afternoon, but we'll be gathering again at 6 p.m. We are recessed till 6 p.m. in room 15. Yep.